8. The White Slave Owners Again. Sontenac's, as dictatorial and self-willed as ever, dominated the commission and began a pronounced pro-black policy. He loved the blacks, said that he wished he was a black man, and lived openly with a mulatto woman. If all the whites had been like Sontenac's, the laborers would have lost their anti-white feelings, by which they meant only anti-slavery. For Lavoie and Sontenac's, they would have done anything. But the blacks could not trust the old slave owners. The British bribed, intrigued, and gave money and guns, and the insurrections all over the colony continued. Sontenac's wrote secretly to the Directory that the blacks hated the whites, but he understood the reason for their hate. 3 weeks after he landed, he published a proclamation in Creole which declared that everyone who was convicted of saying in the markets or elsewhere that the Negroes had not acquired their liberty forever, or that a man could be the property of another man, was a traitor to his country and would be punished accordingly. To reassure a people so sensitive to freedom, he abolished restraint for debt and put at liberty all those who were in prison for this offense. He worked hard to instill into them the necessity for labor. Everybody is free in France, he said, but everybody works. Yet he stood firmly against coercion. Work hard, was his advice, but do not forget that no one has the right of forcing you to dispose of your time against your will. He rigorously forbade beating on the plantations. He instituted schools where blacks were given an elementary education and learnt Greek and Roman history. He sent the sons of the blacks and mulattoes to France to be educated in a special school that the Republic opened for them. He announced that he would not deliver a commission to anyone who could not sign his name. And thus in every house in Le Cap could be seen blacks, men and women, some of 50 years of age, learning to read and write. In the country districts, the laborers begged Sontenac to send them as teachers even young European children who knew how to read and write. The blacks knew their ignorance and were willing to learn from the whites, to be guided by men from France, men like Lavoie and Sontenac, to learn from the white children. All they asked was to be rid forever of the fear of slavery. But the British were there spending millions to enslave them once more. They knew that the old slave owners for whom they worked now as free men would make them slaves again at the first opportunity. Their hope was Toussaint, a black man, ex-slave, with his army of black men, ex-slaves. All the black laborers of San Domingo had their eyes on him. Toussaint, when Sontenac arrived, was second in military rank to Lavoie. He had the confidence of the French government, who sent him presents and letters of congratulation and undertook the education of his sons in Paris. With Lavoie and Sontenac, its representatives in San Domingo, he was on the best of terms. The mulattoes in the north were discredited, and Toussaint, with his army and mass support, was the most powerful man in San Domingo. Is it from this moment that dates his tentative ambition to become master of the island? Many are convinced of this, but it is certainly a false view. What is certain is that Toussaint wanted to become commander-in-chief. And now, with extreme delicacy, he suggested to Lavoie that he could help him to get back to France if he wished. The French Constitution of the year 3 had given San Domingo 7 deputies in the two houses. The elections were to take place in September 1796, and in August, Toussaint told Lavoie that he could get him elected as a representative. Lavoie had sacrificed his health, his wife, his children, and he needed a rest from the intrigues and factions of San Domingo. The excuse offered was perfect. Lavoie had labored in San Domingo through the years of the Revolution and the invasion by the British. Without one trip to France, he had borne the brunt of the fighting, first against the slaves and then against Spaniards and British, as governor and commander-in-chief. His letters to the minister show how much he felt the strain, and he leapt at the chance. He, at any rate, did not suspect Toussaint's motives, or if he did, bore him no grudge. They remained the closest of friends after Laveau's return to France. Their intimate correspondence continued, and Laveau was always Toussaint's staunchest defender. But Sontenac, too, at this same election, though it took place only a few months after his arrival, had himself elected as a representative of the colony in the French Parliament. One of Toussaint's reasons for suggesting Laveau's return was to have a trustworthy representative of the blacks in France. And this was the very reason why Sontenac wanted to go back. The political situation had shifted in France since the abolition of slavery without a debate, and the supporters of Negro liberty had good cause to be nervous. Robespierre and the Mountain had maintained power until July 1794. The Terror had saved France. But long before July, Robespierre had gone far enough and was now lagging behind the revolutionary masses. In the streets of Paris, Jacques Varlet and Roux were preaching communism. Not in production, but in distribution, a natural reaction to the profiteering of the new bourgeoisie. Robespierre, however, revolutionary as he was, remained bourgeois and had reached the extreme limit of the bourgeois revolution. He persecuted the workers. Far more working men than aristocrats perished in this phase of the Terror. In June 1794, the revolutionary armies won a great victory in Belgium, and at once the continuation of the Terror was seen by the public as factional ferocity and not a revolutionary necessity. Right wing and left in the convention combined to strike at this sinister dictator, and when he sent out the call to the people, he could not get the old response. Some of the sections came, but there was a delay. Rain fell, and they went back home again. The revolutionary ardor which had inspired them since August 1792 was gone, killed by Robespierre himself. He seems to have been in constant fear of a split between the extreme revolutionism of Paris and the rest of the country, but destroyed his own left wing and thereby sealed his own doom. The tragedy was that the Paris masses, in leaving him to his fate, were opening the door to worse enemies. Robespierre's successors were the new officialdom, the financial speculators, the buyers of church property, all the new bourgeoisie. They were enemies of royalty, which would guillotine them all if it came back, and avid of social equality, but were determined to keep the masses in their place and willing to ally themselves with the old bourgeoisie, and even some of the aristocracy, in a joint exploitation of the new opportunities created by the revolution. When the masses grasped the trend of affairs, they tried, twice in 1795, to reassert their old power. But the new bourgeois France was too strong for them. They were defeated, reaction increased, and as it grew, the old slave owners, crawling out of their prisons and hiding places, held up their heads again and clamored for order to be restored in San Domingo and the colonies. On the morning after, the convention had not been too happy over abolition. Robespierre seems to have doubted the utility of colonies at all, and probably with the idea of bargaining with Britain, had let it be known that he did not want the colonial question raised, or at all kept quiet. The lucky Sontenacs, a Brissotin and therefore enemy of Robespierre, had arrived back in France before Robespierre fell, and was once more in danger of the guillotine. But with the death of Robespierre, the colonial question came to the fore again. Before the convention was dissolved, Boissy d'Anglas praised the magnificent defense of San Domingo by Toussaint and Rigaud and their armies, and said that they deserved well of the country. Gouly, a colonial deputy, opposed this resolution without success, but he delivered a long address, between the lines of which one could see the clause of restoration, and the convention had this document printed. The new constitution gave France the directory of 5 members and 2 houses, the Council of Elders, and the Council of 500. The two bodies elected on a restricted franchise met in November 1795. The new bourgeoisie dominated both houses. The Jacobins, weary and discredited, were in a minority. Vaublanc, who had fled after August 10th, and a strong clique were members of the Council of 500, and the émigré colonists kept up a ceaseless agitation inside and outside Parliament for the restoration of order in the colonies. What was this order? The blacks had no doubt as to the kind of order that the émigré colonists wished to restore. They did not say slavery openly. The revolution was still too near. But Black San Domingo began to hear that Page, who had written the letter of August 11th, and his friend Brulé, Vaublanc, and other notorious enemies of colonial liberty, were once more active in France. The blacks could deal with local whites whose speech or actions hinted at any return to slavery. The Republic they had always looked upon as their friend. But now, as they heard what was happening in France and heard who were in the new parliament and what they were saying, their doubts grew, and they began to ask all strangers arriving in the colony from France if the Republic was sincere in giving them liberty. The Republic of 1794 had been sincere in giving them liberty, but the Republic of 1796 might be equally sincere in taking it away. In addition to their clamor for the restoration of order, while blacks and mulattoes under Toussaint and Rigaud drained away the blood of Britain, the Republic's chief enemy, the maritime bourgeois and the colonists directed their fire on Sontenac's, as the executioner of the whites and the origin of all the troubles. Sontenac's reached San Domingo in May 1796, but by the time preparations were being made for the San Domingo elections in August, the colonial reaction was making such headway in France that he felt, both in his own defense and for the sake of the blacks, that it would be better if he went back to France as a deputy. The maritime bourgeois and the planters had made an infinite deal of mischief on the colonial question until the Paris masses gave the colony a chance to adapt itself to the new conditions. Now, as soon as they were coming into power again, they began with their old greed, dishonesty, and tricks. The mischief that they would cause this time would be as nothing to what they had done between July 14th, 1789, and August 10th, 1792. When it was all over, they would blame the revolutionaries. Sontenac easily had himself elected, but though he wanted to go, everybody begged him to stay. San Domingo was still unsettled, and his influence was strong. With the blacks, his name was already a talisman. And in an insurrection which took place in the revolutionary center of Port-au-Prince, where whites were massacred, the laborers had risen to cries of, "Long live Sontenac! Long live Sontenac!" Obviously, the blacks, like horses, dogs, cats, and some wild animals, judged a man not by the color of his skin, but by the way he behaved. British agents, well supplied with money, were always moving among them, stirring up strife and encouraging disorder. French royalists were doing the same. The situation was extremely uncertain, and all classes, white and black, asked Sontenac not to go. The municipality of Le Cap, mulatto and black officers, Clairvaux, Moïse, and Christophe begged him to remain. Moïse, supposed to be an implacable hater of the whites, told Sontenac that if he left, he would resign, as the colony would most certainly be thrown into disorder. And at a meeting of the commissioners, Raymond, Leblanc, and Giraud told him that if he went, they would not remain behind. They feared for their lives. Thus pressed, Sontenac stayed. Portrayed in France as the executioner of the whites and disruptor of the colony, he was in reality a rallying center for blacks and whites so long as they were Republicans. But he was without mercy against the old slave owners, and these were the ones who were most clamorous in France. Toussaint, too, pressed him to stay. And far from having arranged the election of Sontenax in order to get rid of him, as is commonly urged, Toussaint told the Directory that the safety of the colony depended upon Sontenax being left as commissioner, at least until peace with Britain was declared. Unfortunately, Sontenax, true representative of the Revolution, was also the agent of the French Republic, sent to ensure that France and not the mulattoes should rule the colony. The mulatto stronghold was the South under Rigaud, who carried on the war against the British with such skill and vigor as to draw again and again praise, even from an English Tory historian. By 1797, Rigaud was master of a large part of the South. He had 6,000 men and a detachment of cavalry. Each battalion chief commanded a cantonment with absolute power, carrying out all civil and political functions. No black held rank above that of captain, and, unlike Toussaint, Rigaud kept the whites in rigid subjection, excluding them from every position of importance. Rigaud was undoubtedly narrow-minded. He wore always a brown wig with straight hair to give him an appearance as close to that of a white man as possible. This sensitiveness to color is usually accompanied in active men by great bitterness against the oppressing race. And the narrowness of Rigaud's organization and his exclusion of whites and blacks from all positions of power undoubtedly owed something to his personal character. But fundamentally, it lay in the very circumstances of the mulattoes. They were hopelessly outnumbered by the blacks. They, more than the illiterate blacks, knew about the émigré propaganda and intrigues for the restoration of white supremacy. Toussaint did not trust the whites at all, but the blacks were so backward that he had to use whites. The mulattoes were better equipped. Though not all of them were educated, yet there were enough of them to govern. And if they established a mulatto oligarchy, not only past events, but future were to prove that the whites at least were the last persons whose complaints should have been listened to. Rigaud and his followers had abandoned slavery, but they were hard on the black laborers. They made them understand that their freedom was due to the mulattoes. They confined them to the plantations, and Rigaud's prisons were filled with whites and blacks in irons, but never a single mulatto. He had as his chief advisor Pinchina, and they restored cultivation to such an extent that Rigaud never asked for any financial assistance from the French government and paid for his own ammunition. Yet he was a true friend of the Republic. He dismissed all the bribes the British offered him, and, unlike Toussaint, shot without mercy all, even mulattoes, who intrigued with the British. Whatever Sontenax's instructions, he should have left Rigaud alone, at least until the peace. But, overconfident, he tackled Rigaud without the means to enforce his will. He had not been long in the colony when he dispatched to the South a commission of three, General de Fourneau and Ray, two white men, and Le Borgne, a mulatto. De Fourneau was to bring Rigaud's army under his own control. The commission was to restore equality among citizens of all color. Sontenax's instructions were particularly stringent on this. It was to investigate whether the plot on March 20th had any roots in the South, and it was to arrest Pinchina and bring him to Le Cap to account for his share in that conspiracy. Pinchina, who was the idol of the South and of the mulattoes all over the colony. Toussaint told Sontenax not to attempt such a thing. He and Rigaud respected and indeed had an admiration for each other. Rigaud never had any personal jealousy of Toussaint, because Toussaint was a Negro, and cooperated against the British under Toussaint's orders. Toussaint thought that Sontenax should begin by having a conference. Above all, he warned Sontenax against sending Ray, who was an enemy of Rigaud's, and had tried to assassinate him in Le Quai. Sontenax would not listen. Never was an expedition more certain of failure. and its adventures give a useful idea of the social chaos with which Toussaint had to deal. Rigaud, though suspicious, welcomed the commissioners and treated them with the greatest respect. The commissioners duly noted the power which Rigaud and his officers exercised. But unmindful of this, wherever they journeyed, they stirred up the laborers against Rigaud's government, telling them that the mulattoes were oppressing them. Unrest among laborers and soldiers began wherever the commissioners passed. Their private conduct was unsatisfactory. They piled up great expenses, gambled for hours in the private homes at which they stayed, and entertained loose women in a loose way. Rigaud was engaged to a young woman, Marie Villeneuve. Ray seduced her, and when Rigaud came to see him, told him smilingly, "Rigaud, I am going to introduce you to the most beautiful girl in Le Quai, but promise me to tell no one." Taking him into the bedroom, he drew the curtains of the bed and showed him Marie Villeneuve. Rigaud, a man of notoriously violent temper, threw himself on Ray, knocked him down, and was about to hurl him over the balcony into the street when the servants rushed in and saved him. One of the commissioners stupidly asked Rigaud what he thought would happen if they arrested Pinchinat. Yet Rigaud and the mulattoes continued to show an exemplary patience. The delegation attempted an expedition against enemy territory. De Fourneau, acting as chief officer, would not take the advice of the local officers, and his column was badly beaten. Coming back in a temper, he arrested the treasurer of the South, as he had been ordered to do, and also arrested a mulatto officer for some offense. While this officer was being conducted towards the harbor, he met a group of his own soldiers. He made a dash for safety, got safely among his own men, and the simmering insurrection began. The European soldiers and the National Guard stood by the government delegation, but the mulattoes all took the part of Rigaud. That night, Rigaud's brother raised the black laborers who, however hard their lot, would always follow anyone who they thought was for them against slavery. Beauvais, knowing that the commissioners were severely to blame, but recognizing their authority as representatives of the government, tried to make peace between the two parties. The mulattoes refused to listen to him and said they would wait for Rigaud. Ray and De Fourneau fled, and the mulattoes and the blacks in full insurrection massacred scores of whites, who of course were all for the commission. Le Borgne and Kerverso, another European officer, were only saved because Beauvais, although powerless to stop the excitement, never left them for a single moment. Rigaud was the only man who could have restored calm, but Rigaud would not come. He was fond of an expression, "How terrible is the rage of the people." And when he heard of the massacre in Le Quai, all he would do was to say this over and over again. At last, Kerverso and Le Borgne gave authority to Rigaud to reestablish quiet. Rigaud issued a proclamation stating that he had been officially put in control of the government, and immediately calm was restored. Le Borgne and Kerverso left, and Rigaud remained master of the South. He and his people had been grossly provoked, but they were guilty of rebellion. Sontenac refused to receive the delegations that the municipality of Le Quai sent to him to explain the unfortunate occurrences. The South tried Rheum, the other commissioner. Rheum also refused to listen. The municipality sent two whites to Paris to plead its case. When after some delay these two reached Paris, they turned against Rigaud and became his accusers instead of his defenders. Sontenac reorganized the geographical division of Saint-Domingo so as to bring two districts of the South within the jurisdiction of the government. The inhabitants, spurred on by Rigaud, drove out the officers whom Sontenac sent to take charge. Sontenac sent a condemnatory proclamation. The citizens of Le Quai dragged it through the streets at the tail of an ass. Pinchinat, elected among others as representative to the French Parliament for the South, was refused permission to sit when he reached Paris. The breach between the South under Rigaud and the government, both in Saint-Domingue and in France, was complete. But Rigaud sent a representative to put his case to Toussaint. Sontenac heard of it and wanted to have him arrested. Toussaint refused and protected Rigaud's man. Thus, in the last months of 1796 and at the beginning of 1797, Toussaint was in close relationship with Rigaud, who was in a very uncertain position. The British had a good opportunity during all this confusion and might have conquered the colony then. They have even claimed that at about this time, Rigaud entered into negotiations with them. However that may be, the mulattoes, repelled by the Republic, drew nearer to the blacks under Toussaint. But while Rigaud and his people looked upon Sontenac as their worst enemy, Toussaint maintained the friendliest relations with the commissioner. Sought after by blacks, mulattoes, and whites, the suave and discreet Toussaint was gradually becoming the one man in Saint-Domingue on whom everything hinged. Sontenac continued to rule with energy. His other colleagues, except Raymond, left him. Room was in Spanish Saint-Domingue. Sontenac intrigued among the black generals, but solely for his own power and without any designs against their liberty. Rochambeau, a white general, objected to the wealth and dominance of the black generals, and Sontenac sent him home at once. Against white arrogance or the white émigrés, Sontenac was as fierce an enemy as any black laborer. He wanted to sweep the aristocrats off the face of the earth. Toussaint used to send assistance to his old master in America, Bayou de Libertas. He wanted to get him back, but bowed to the law against émigrés, and Sontenac was especially pleased at this instance of Toussaint's civism. Sontenac held frequent revolutionary demonstrations and made the children in the schools spend many hours singing revolutionary hymns. But he worked also at the restoration of the colony. Le Cap was partially rebuilt, and cultivation began to flourish. On a plantation in the North Plain, a little Negro named Brossard had the confidence of both blacks and whites. He got the laborers to work on a promise of a fourth part of the produce, and he raised the capital to begin production again. The experiment was a great success, and plantations were farmed out by the government on this new principle. Toussaint encouraged his generals and other notabilities to adopt the system, by which everybody, including the state, profited. Dessalines, in time, had 30 plantations farmed out to him. Toussaint popularized certain slogans by repeating them over and over again. "I do not wish to be any coast Negro," was one of them, referring to the primitive needs of the Africans from the slave coast. "The guarantee of the liberty of the blacks is the prosperity of agriculture," was another saying always on his lips, which spread among the blacks. Banditry, idleness, murder, these things still continued as they continued in France until the advent of Bonaparte. But torn and devastated as Saint-Domingue still was, the colony had definitely taken an upward turn by the early months of 1797. Toussaint was appointed commander-in-chief and governor on the recommendation of Sontenac, who installed him in Le Cap with an imposing ceremony. The name of Sontenac was in the mouth of every black. Here, astonishing sight, was a white man who protected the liberties and privileges of all, laborers and generals alike, as if he had once been a slave himself. On the 17th of August, 1797, Toussaint went into Le Cap and called on Sontenac. After a few minutes there, he visited the commissioner Raymond and told him that the colony would be in serious danger if Sontenac did not leave at once. He did not wish to use violence against Sontenac, because of his official position, but Raymond, being his brother commissioner, should ask him to leave for Paris to take up his post as deputy. He said he could not give his reasons. Raymond was thunderstruck, as well he might be. Toussaint and Sontenac were the best of friends. What had happened? He was also frightened. This was a very serious step with incalculable consequences. Next day, Toussaint told Raymond that Sontenac was preparing a catastrophe, that the whites who were still in San Domingo would be murdered. He accused Sontenac of wishing to raise the blacks against the whites. They argued with Toussaint fruitlessly and tried to point out to him the gravity of the step, which might lead to disorder and civil war in a colony which was peaceful at last. Raymond and Pascal, General Secretary of the Commission, went to Sontenac and told him what they had heard. Toussaint then came, but Sontenac said he preferred to speak to Toussaint alone. Why? Sontenac failed to convince Toussaint and finally agreed to go, if Toussaint would give him a valedictory letter. Next day, Raymond and Pascal came again, and Toussaint, still keeping silence as to his reasons, told them of the proposed letter. The two went to Sontenac and came back with a draft, which they asked Toussaint to sign and to get his staff to sign also. Toussaint summoned his officers, and the letter was read to them. Some, whom Sontenac had already got at, refused to sign. Others, wondering what this was all about, said they would wait to hear what were the intentions of the commissioner himself. Pascal ran to Sontenac and begged him to clear the air by saying what he intended to do. But Sontenac, on learning the attitude of these officers, refused to say anything and even seemed disposed to resist. Toussaint then told the officers they could sign if they wanted to or not, as they pleased. Sontenac, he said, wanted to go to France to take up his duty as a deputy and had asked for this letter. He had called them together to sign it, not to deliberate over it, as that would be against the law. Some signed, including Moïse and Christophe. Others went away, of whom a few came back afterwards and wanted to sign. Toussaint would not allow it. He said that he was not begging them to oblige him. He was ready to sign the letter alone and take full responsibility. This was typical of Toussaint, who had been trained as a slave and then as a soldier. He never troubled to explain overmuch to subordinates. Their business was to obey. The letter was full of compliments to Sontenac for his work and of the urgency of someone like him being in France to defend the liberty of the blacks. Raymond took the letter with the signatures to Sontenac, who replied with another complimentary epistle. Toussaint, who always carried on a diplomatic intrigue in the most ceremonial manner, replied with yet another. Sontenac had been given 3 days, but he sought to gain time, stirring up the officers friendly to him. One morning at 4 o'clock, Toussaint had the alarm cannon fired and sent General Agier to tell Raymond that if Sontenac did not leave at once, he would enter the town and embark him by force. It was the end of Sontenac. Accompanied by his mistress, Raymond, and some officers friendly to him, Sontenac traversed the streets of Le Cap on his way to the boat. The population watched him go, dumb with sorrow and bewilderment. He was immensely popular with all the blacks, but Toussaint had said he was to go, and after that, nothing could save him. What was behind this extraordinary episode, an unsolved enigma to this day? Toussaint's explanation, the secret that he guarded, was that since the end of 1796, Sontenac had at various times suggested to him that he should massacre the whites and declare the colony independent. This was what Toussaint wrote in a long letter to the Directory, in which he gave an account in dramatic form of the various interviews in which Sontenac had made this proposal to him. Here is part of Toussaint's story. He was installed as commander-in-chief on May 2, 1797. On that day, after the ceremony, he was mounting his horse to go back to Gonaïves when Sontenac stopped him, asked him into his house, and again broached the subject. "I am very, very pleased. I am enchanted at seeing you, commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the colony. We are in a position now to do exactly what we want. You have influence on all the inhabitants. It is imperative for us to execute our project. This is the most suitable moment. Circumstances were never more favorable, and no one is better able to act than you and I. Toussaint replied,
That is to say, Commissioner, that you wish to destroy me? To kill all the whites and make ourselves independent? Yet you had promised me that you would not speak to me again about these projects.
Yes, but you see that it is absolutely indispensable. Thus goes on page after page, this curious dramatic dialogue, with the same actors, the same theme, but only time and place differing. How much truth was there in it? Nobody knows for certain. When Sontenac defended himself against this charge in Paris, he said that he had left Saint-Domingo of his own free will, which was a lie. He claimed to have discovered a plot by priests and émigrés of which Toussaint was the instrument, to get rid of the commission. This was nonsense. He also accused Raymond of conspiring with Toussaint to invite him by means of the letter to leave for France. But both Pascal and Raymond could easily refute this statement. If anyone should be accused of independence, said Sontenac, it should be Toussaint. And he charged Toussaint with being surrounded by émigré whites, with organizing the revolt of 1791, with fighting for the Spanish king and leaving him only when he heard of negotiations for peace and knew that the king of Spain would not need him any longer. All this was partly lies, partly nonsense. If Sontenac were not guilty, his defense was a poor one. But it is no easier to understand Toussaint's side either. He was certainly lying when he portrayed himself as being angry with Sontenac for making such treacherous proposals. Up to a few days before his visit to Le Cap, he and Sontenac were, and had been, close friends. He said that since the end of 1796, Sontenac had made these proposals to him. On February 1st, 1797, he had written to the minister asking him not to believe insinuations that Sontenac and Raymond were betraying the interests of France, and asking that Sontenac should remain.
The safety of Saint-Domingo, its entire restoration, demands that the Directory should not permit him to return. My attachment to France, the love of the fatherland and of my brothers, oblige me to make the request of you.
On June 15th, in a letter to Sontenac, Toussaint signed himself, Friendship Without End. On June 16th, he wrote to Mentor, another black, that the measures of the commission had been all approved.
How joyful Sontenac will be. I will be glad to be near him, to embrace him, and to tell him my satisfaction. This satisfaction makes me forget for a moment my vexations.
Yet a few weeks after, to the astonishment of everyone, he was insisting with all the strength of his unbreakable will that Sontenac was to go. Nothing that happened in Saint-Domingo can explain this. The explanation, as with so much in the history of Saint-Domingo, must be sought in France. What was happening there changed Toussaint's views, and with them, the course of the Black Revolution. The planters in the Paris of 1797 were nearly as noisy, if not quite as powerful, as they had been in 1791. The revolution in France was dead. Babeuf had arrived at the conclusion that political equality could only be achieved by a drastic change in economic organization. The Directory's police reported that working men and women were eagerly reading Babeuf's writings, but the fighting enthusiasm of the old days had been broken by defeat and disappointment. Babeuf's attempt failed miserably, and the bourgeoisie took advantage of the reaction to stabilize itself. Respectable Jacobin deputies, who had probably never heard the name of Babeuf until he was captured, were accused of terrorism and anarchism. And of 216 former members of the convention who were due to retire in March 1797, scarcely a dozen were re-elected. So far had reaction gone that the president of the elders was Barbé de Marbois, the intendant who had been chased from Saint-Domingo by the Patriots in 1789. Vaublanc and his party, therefore, immensely reinforced after the new elections, carried on as in the good old days. Why are the blacks armed? Asked Bourdon. To destroy all parties?
the unfortunate white colonists had decreased from 40,000 to 25,000. Some days later, Bourdon gave a new message to the Directory about massacres and denounced the official report as lies. Why were the whites in San Domingo suffering? The Directory was pardoning royalists in France. Of 1,500 requests for restoration of rights from émigrés, only 166 had been rejected. Yet in the colonies, this persecution was going on. At last, in May, the Directory was able to send a message from San Domingo. It was from Toussaint. Hatred of the English, he said, had united all parties. The English had put the crown on their atrocities by inventing cuirasses studded with sharp pointed pieces of steel, which they threw among the Republican soldiers when it came to hand fighting, knowing that most of the blacks were barefooted. But this hateful device has only turned out to their shame. Our soldiers have defied these weapons with an unconquerable rage and have proved that no obstacle is able to stop men carrying arms for liberty. At this stirring message, an echo from an age that still lingered faintly in their ears, the deputies broke into enthusiastic applause and demanded that it should be printed. But Vaublanc raged and stormed, said the whole was a pack of lies, nothing could be more ridiculous, and on May 27th, he made the fiercest attack yet made on Sontenac's. He is covered with the blood of the whites. He has made atrocious laws, which the tigers of Libya would not make if tigers had the misfortune to need laws. He has raised impositions. He has pocketed vast sums of which he has given no account. All of this was untrue. If Sontenac had had whites killed, it had been in defense of the Republic. He had not stolen any money. To the end of his days, he remained a poor man. It was his legislation in favor of the blacks that was driving Vaublanc and the colonists wild. Vaublanc blamed Sontenac and Laveau as having contributed most to the spirit of insubordination among the blacks. Day after day, he abused Sontenac and the blacks, those blacks without whom the colony would assuredly have been British. Barbey accused the laborers of being the passive and servile instruments of Sontenac's crimes. De La Haye said that San Domingo needed new agents with an imposing force. On June 1st, the Directory sent a message to the House from Raymond describing all that was being done for cultivation. Bourdon said it was a pack of lies, that the proprietors were being chased away, and that the commissioners were putting the money in their pockets. Vaublanc said that the same boat which brought Raymond's dispatch had brought Martial Bess, a Creole general, who said that the colony was in the wildest disorder. He asked for the recall of Sontenac. Guérin Coulon defended Sontenac, but finally, a motion proposed by Vaublanc and Villarette Joyeuse was carried by an enormous majority, and on June 3rd, the House decided on the recall of Raymond, Roume, and Sontenac. In the course of his speech, Villarette Joyeuse said that the military regime was the only one which would save San Domingo and save the unhappy whites from the daggers of the Negroes. He and Vaublanc demanded that San Domingo should be put in a state of siege until the peace. On June 12th, the Council of Elders approved the motion for the recall. Sontenac most certainly had friends in France who kept him informed. Toussaint, we know, had his private agents. But even without these special sources of information, San Domingo knew, for the news was appearing day by day in the Moniteur, the official journal. The Moniteur of June 12th carried an announcement of a letter from Lord G to the Directory requesting a passport for an English representative to Paris to discuss terms of peace. Peace had been in the air for a long time. If terms of peace were being discussed, then France might soon be able to devote attention to San Domingo and to send troops. Sontenac knew the strength of the counter-revolution in France. He could see exactly where the steady growing reaction would end. He himself would lose his head, and the colony would ultimately be restored to slavery. He might not have expressed himself so freely to Toussaint, as Toussaint described in his dispatch.
But it is not impossible that, sick and tired of the reaction and fearing for the future, he had proposed to Toussaint that they should seize the colony, purge it of the white slave owners, and make it independent. Toussaint, very careful, would reject these advances while bearing Sontenac's, friend of the blacks, no ill will for them. But sometime in July, Toussaint got news of the decree recalling Sontenac's and of the reception which the speeches of Vaublanc, Barbet, and the others had got. There was obviously a terrific struggle ahead, and he and his ally, Rigaud, in disgrace with the Directory, would have to fight. With his usual decision, he made up his mind to throw Sontenac's to the wolves at once. What other reason can be assigned for his violent volte-face? Whatever the reasons for his dismissal of Sontenac's, the fact itself was of enormous significance. Henceforth, the French government suspected Toussaint of a design to make the colony independent, and Toussaint feared the intention of the French to restore slavery. The Directory itself had no intention of restoring slavery. But the Directory might not continue in power, and no one knew what its successors would do. It is from this time that Toussaint, driven by events, envisaged the necessity of holding on to power even at the cost of defying France. How acutely he had foreseen the course of French politics was proven by the events of the next few months. For the men who were now reaping the fruits of the revolution, the restoration of order in San Domingo was only one item in a general wave of reaction they were forcing on France as fast as they could. They admitted deputies hitherto ineligible, suppressed the revolutionary clubs, revoked the laws relating to the deportation and dismissal of priests who would not take the oath to the Republic, reorganized the National Guard in such a manner as to exclude the more democratic elements. But they were going too fast. Some of their chiefs were even intriguing with royalty, and the new bourgeoisie did not want royalty and feudalism back again. Even the weary and cheated masses would support their new masters against those outworn and discredited creeds. The Directory was watching this tide of reaction, and, itself rotten with corruption, was powerless to stop it. Suddenly, it got the proofs of a royalist conspiracy and decided to use them against these brazen relics of the Ancien Régime, whether royalist or no. On the night of the 18 Fructidor, September 3rd, they were arrested. A coup d'etat banished 65 of them to the Guyanas and checked for a time the descent of the revolution. Among the 65 were Vaublanc, Villerette Joyeuse, Barbet de Marbois, Bourdon, de La Haye, and Dumas, all of them implacable enemies of the new regime in San Domingo. Black freedom was saved for a time, but Toussaint had had a serious shock. On November 5th, he addressed a letter to the Directory, which is a milestone in his career. He did not know then of the coup d'etat of the 18th Fructidor, when Vaublanc and his band had got their deserts. He wrote still under the belief that the reactionary group of old slave owners had strong influence in the legislature. The Directory itself he did not accuse openly, but he let it see that he no longer had confidence in it, and that henceforth the blacks were going to watch every party in France. The impolitic and incendiary discourse of Vaublanc has not affected the blacks nearly so much as their certainty of the projects which the proprietors of San Domingo are planning. Insidious declarations should not have any effect in the eyes of wise legislators who have decreed liberty for the nations. But the attempts on that liberty, which the colonists propose, are all the more to be feared, because it is with the veil of patriotism that they cover their detestable plans. We know that they seek to impose some of them on you by illusory and specious promises, in order to see renewed in this colony its former scenes of horror. Already, perfidious emissaries have stepped in among us to ferment the destructive leaven prepared by the hands of liberticides. But they will not succeed. I swear it by all that liberty holds most sacred. My attachment to France, my knowledge of the blacks, make it my duty not to leave you ignorant either of the crimes which they meditate or the oath that we renew. To bury ourselves under the ruins of a country revived by liberty rather than suffer the return of slavery. It is for you, citizens, directors, to turn from over our heads the storm which the eternal enemies of our liberty are preparing in the shades of silence. It is for you to enlighten the legislature. It is for you to prevent the enemies of the present system from spreading themselves on our unfortunate shores to sully it with new crimes. Do not allow our brothers, our friends, to be sacrificed to men who wish to reign over the ruins of the human species. But no, your wisdom will enable you to avoid the dangerous snares which our common enemies hold out for you. I send you with this letter a declaration which will acquaint you with the unity that exists between the proprietors of San Domingo who are in France, those in the United States, and those who serve under the English banner. You will see there a resolution, unequivocal and carefully constructed, for the restoration of slavery. You will see there that their determination to succeed has led them to envelop themselves in the mantle of liberty in order to strike it more deadly blows. You will see that they are counting heavily on my complacency in lending myself to their perfidious views by my fear for my children. It is not astonishing that these men, who sacrifice their country to their interests, are unable to conceive how many sacrifices a true love of country can support in a better father than they. Since I unhesitatingly base the happiness of my children on that of my country, which they and they alone wish to destroy, I shall never hesitate between the safety of San Domingo and my personal happiness. But I have nothing to fear. It is to the solicitude of the French government that I have confided my children. I would tremble with horror if it was into the hands of the colonists that I had sent them as hostages. But even if it were so, let them know that in punishing them for the fidelity of their father, they would only add one degree more to their barbarism, without any hope of ever making me fail in my duty. Blind as they are, they cannot see how this odious conduct on their part can become the signal of new disasters and irreparable misfortunes, and that far from making them regain what in their eyes liberty for all has made them lose, they expose themselves to a total ruin and the colony to its inevitable destruction. Do they think that men who have been able to enjoy the blessing of liberty will calmly see it snatched away? They supported their chains only so long as they did not know any condition of life more happy than that of slavery. But today, when they have left it, if they had 1,000 lives, they would sacrifice them all rather than be forced into slavery again. But no, the same hand which has broken our chains will not enslave us anew. France will not revoke her principles. She will not withdraw from us the greatest of her benefits. She will protect us against all our enemies. She will not permit her sublime morality to be perverted, those principles which do her most honor to be destroyed, her most beautiful achievement to be degraded, and her decree of 16 pluvios, which so honors humanity, to be revoked. But if, to reestablish slavery in San Domingo, this was done, then I declare to you it would be to attempt the impossible. We have known how to face dangers to obtain our liberty. We shall know how to brave death to maintain it. This, citizens, directors, is the morale of the people of San Domingo. Those are the principles that they transmit to you by me. My own, you know. It is sufficient to renew, my hand and yours, the oath that I have made,
to cease to live before gratitude dies in my heart, before I cease to be faithful to France and to my duty, before the God of liberty is profaned and sullied by the liberticides, before they can snatch from my hands that sword, those arms, which France confided to me for the defense of its rights and those of humanity, for the triumph of liberty and equality. Pericles on Democracy, Paine on the Rights of Man, the Declaration of Independence, the Communist Manifesto. These are some of the political documents which, whatever the wisdom or weaknesses of their analysis, have moved men and will always move them. For the writers, some of them in spite of themselves, strike chords and awaken aspirations that sleep in the hearts of the majority in every age. But Pericles, Tom Paine, Jefferson, Marx, and Engels were men of a liberal education, formed in the tradition of ethics, philosophy, and history. Toussaint was a slave, not 6 years out of slavery, bearing alone the unaccustomed burden of war and government, dictating his thoughts in the crude words of a broken dialect, written and rewritten by his secretaries until their devotion and his will had hammered them into adequate shape. Superficial people have read his career in terms of personal ambition. This letter is their answer. Personal ambition he had. But he accomplished what he did because, superbly gifted, he incarnated the determination of his people never, never to be slaves again. Soldier and administrator above all, yet his declaration is a masterpiece of prose excelled by no other writer of the Revolution. Leader of a backward and ignorant mass, he was yet in the forefront of the great historical movement of his time. The blacks were taking their part in the destruction of European feudalism begun by the French Revolution. And liberty and equality, the slogans of the Revolution, meant far more to them than to any Frenchman. That was why, in the hour of danger, Toussaint, uninstructed as he was, could find the language and accent of Diderot, Rousseau, and Raynal, of Mirabeau, Robespierre, and Danton. And in one respect, he excelled them all. For even these masters of the spoken and written word, owing to the class complications of their society, too often had to pause, to hesitate, to qualify. Toussaint could defend the freedom of the blacks without reservation, and this gave to his declaration a strength and a single-mindedness rare in the great documents of the time. The French bourgeoisie could not understand it. Rivers of blood were to flow before they understood that, elevated as was his tone, Toussaint had written neither bombast nor rhetoric, but the simple and sober truth.